The following is a recording of Bhava Lal presenting The Changing Landscape of Space on February 7th, 2020.
Just one correction to what John said. You won't be able to see her image. Dr. Lal is using slides today, and you'll be able to see those slides. So when you come up here to ask a question, you can see her on the screen that we have at the lectern here. So our fascination with space is not new. The world was shocked in 1958 with Sputnik. We, the United States, responded with new goals and an emphasis on preparing the next generation of teachers. But things have changed since 1958, to no surprise. Other countries have found space and the opportunities exploration and development represent. Corporations seem to now have taken the lead in the next generation of satellite exploration. Our speaker today, Dr. Vall's research, is on the cutting edge of examining the trends and offerings and offering policy suggestions as it relates to globalizing and democratizing landscape of space. You've read her bio in our emails, on our website, and this morning on the slides. Suffice it to say, her credentials go to infinity and beyond. So join me in welcoming Dr. Lal, live from Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Joan. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I apologize again for not being there. It was a tough day at the airport yesterday, and they still haven't returned our luggage. So hopefully that will be back today. Let me get started. I think my first slide is up. The title of the talk today is Global Trends in Space. My name is Bhavya Lal. I will go to slide two for a sec, Joan. And again, you have my bio already. I'm an engineer by training, but I also have policy credentials. I have worked in the space sector for quite a few years. What you see on the slide is some of the fun things I do in my free time. So on the left side, those of you who know the Apollo program, Joan just mentioned it. That's an F1 engine, which was part of the Saturn V rocket that took us to the moon. And on the right is me with Buzz Aldrin, who was a member of the Apollo 11 crew. As you all know, we had the 50th anniversary of Apollo last year. And so much has happened since then. Moving on to the next slide, just a quick sec, where I work, the Science and Technology Policy Institute, STPI. Was created by Congress in 1991. It's the only FFRDC that supports the Executive Office of the President, in particular the Office of Science and Technology Policy, but we also provide scientific and technical advice to other federal agencies and organizations. So the National Space Council, which actually was just recently recreated, NASA, Office of the Director for National Intelligence, Department of Defense, so sort of across the board, any department or agency where there is space-related activity underway. Okay, so if we can go on to slide, I'm just going to skip the next one to slide five. Just a recent picture that the person you see on the left is Kelvin Drogemeyer inside the circle, and he's the head of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. In principle, he's a science advisor to the president. In practice, it's usually different for different presidents. And in the middle, of course, is our vice president, Mike Pence, and he was the one who is the chair of the National Space Council, another organization we support as part of our work at STPI. Okay, so I will get launched into the topic of the day, which is global trends in space. So before we get into what's happening in the rest of the world, I want to kind of give you a baseline. And I want to talk about the many different ways you can assess the size or strength of a country in space. Expenditure is one way to capture it. And what you're seeing on the screen is government space expenditures in 2018. This is the most recent data that's available. And as you can see, the United States is well over 50% of the total government space budget across the world. China is a close second, followed by Russia, France, Japan, and Germany. So I think one of the points that I want to make is, even as we talk about how the rest of the world is coming up, it is important that we understand that United States is still the big 800-pound gorilla in the room, spending $41 billion globally on space. About half of this is NASA, and the other half is other agencies, principally the Department of Defense. Okay, so another way to assess the strength of the space sector, since money buys different quantities of goods and services, is the number of launches. So if we can go to the next slide, slide 7, you can see, you know, the blue in the bottom is the United States, and the coral is first the Soviet Union and then Russia. So if you assess the space sector just by the number of launches, you will see the glorious age of the Soviet Union in the 70s and 80s, and you know, so the slow rise of China in more recent years. An interesting point to note in this chart, if you can see it well, is the bottom half, which is commercial activities. And you can see, as government activities are slowing down, commercial activities are taking off. So the very deep blue on the very right side is SpaceX, and you can see how quickly SpaceX, the number of launches SpaceX has, is increasing. Moving on to the next slide, slide 8, I think the third point on sort of the strength of a nation is the number of objects in space. And there's one other chart, so if this isn't very clear, we can look at the next one as well. But the point this chart makes is that essentially globally there are three main players, the United States, Russia, and China. And there's the rest of the world as well. You see again France, Japan, India, European Space Agency, and some global consortia. But there are three main players. An important observation here is, and again, many of you may already know this, is that only a fraction of what we have in space is actual satellites. Most of it, and if you do the math, it's about 90%. Most of what we have in space today is debris, rocket bodies, old broken satellites, pieces of various satellites and things. In space, what goes up doesn't come down so easily. And again, the next chart reinforces the same point. If you look at, this is data from the Department of Defense, all publicly available, but if you catalog the number of objects in Earth orbit by country of origin, you see that a small number of countries dominate the world. Now, having established this baseline, I want to start to talk about where are things headed. And that is where it starts to get really interesting. So I won't have a whole lot of data, but if this is something that you are interested in, I will get the slides, the data slides to Joan, and you can get them from her. So if we go to slide 10, and there's a lot of words on the slide, but I will read it. Because, and then I will break it down. So what are the drivers of these trends in space in recent years and in the coming years? And the bottom line there is that better and cheaper technology, especially in commercial and IT sectors, has led to the development of, one, newer and lower cost space-based applications, products and services, which in turn have accelerated space investments globally and spawned new users and suppliers that are following diverse approaches to space development. I'm now going to break this down a little bit to talk about each of these areas, and that's why they're actually color-coded. So the first is better and cheaper technology. Yeah, when we first started in the space sector, the 1950s, 1950, seven, as Joan mentioned, was when Sputnik was launched. We were inventing a lot of the technologies that went into space. The first ICs that were in integrated circuits that were developed were purchased by MIT for NASA. Each of them cost $9,000. Today they cost pennies. So there is space technology, because it had to be invented for a very specific kind of reason, is now starting to get very, very cheap. The size of the satellites, for example, is going down, and each satellite, which was in the olden days, you know, costing hundreds or even billions of dollars, can now be in the single millions of dollars. A very specific example is this company called Planet, which I'm sure some of you may have heard of. They have hundreds of small satellites, cube satellites the size of a bread box. And these satellites cost in the tens of thousands of dollars. And when something costs that little, you can do a lot of experimenting. So for example, many of these satellites, instead of using specialized space-based technology, are using equipment that's considered commercial off-the-shelf costs. For example, reaction engines and spacecraft are using equipment that's used in dental offices. And because these satellites are now cheaper, organizations are able to take more risks. So Blue Origin, for example, instead of using specialized cleaning chemicals, can just use Home Depot purchase cleaners, and reducing the cost of their activities by orders of magnitude. If you read the newspaper this morning, you must have read that a company, a British company called OneWeb, launched 34 satellites this morning. Each of those satellites weighs about 150 kilograms, or about 300-ish pounds, and it's compared to, let's say, a Hughes satellite from the 1980s, which weighed 13,000 pounds. So the amount, the speed with which technology is getting better, cheaper, and smaller is being manifested in the space sector. Second part of what I wanted to say on this chart was, what happens when things are cheaper? What happens is now you start seeing newer and lower cost applications, because data collection is cheaper, data provision becomes cheaper as well. And just 5 years ago, buying a space-based imagery cost tens of thousands or even millions of dollars, depending on the resolution. Today, you can buy a space-based image for hundreds of dollars. And when things get this cheap, new applications emerge. So for example, a company called Astroscale, which developed in Singapore and actually now is very much based out of Japan and has just recently opened an office in the United States as well, they're offering debris removal services. And remember I said a couple slides ago that most of what we have in space is debris. Governments aren't offering those services yet, or governments aren't cleaning broken satellites in space, but small companies are starting to offer these services, and these are brand new services. You know, 5-10 years ago, we did not have any entity that would say, hey, we can clean space. Another company, and this is an American company, not Asian, Orbit Fab, is offering propellant in space. They offer to refuel your satellite in space. Some of the most expensive parts of a satellite, and the reason a satellite goes, basically needs to be replaced, is it runs out of propellant. So this company, Orbit Fab, is saying, hey, we can provide you propellant in space. These are the kind of services that are unheard of in the space sector. And that is one of the big changes we are starting to see. Another big change, a newer application, is assembly and manufacturing in space. So in the olden days, and again, when I say olden, I really only mean like 10 years ago, 5 years ago, you had to launch fully built satellites. Today, you can launch a satellite in pieces and assemble it in space. And again, some of these are emerging trends, and we are doing them at a small scale. But the point is that in the next 5 to 10 years, these will start to get more mainstream services. The next point on the slide is, when things are cheaper and there's new kinds of services available, it gets people more interested in space. And so there is growing global space investments. These investments are coming not from countries that we hear about, you know, China, Russia, India. but they're coming from countries which we didn't hear so much about being active in space. One example is UAE, United Arab Emirates. They have announced a major space program and a mission to Mars. And they're putting serious money into it. As I mentioned Singapore already, a very small country, but investing pretty heavily in the satellite sector. Another country, Argentina. And again, many of these countries are not investing in government programs, they're investing in the private sector. And there's actually implications to that, and I will come to that as well. And this is all sort of, these are all connected pieces, right? So as things get cheaper, more players enter the sector, there's more product and services being provided, but also that also means, and it's all connected, so there's a greater number of users as well. So purchasers of space data are no longer companies, they are private organizations. You know, banks in Indonesia are able to privately finance and launch satellites and get data from them. Individuals and nonprofits can task satellites and do things that are important for them. So, for example, there's a nonprofit that's tracking abductions in Sudan. There's nonprofits that they are tracking piracy on the high seas. And the reason they can do it is it's cheaper. They can. It's possible. There's companies that are willing to have private entities as customers. And when those things happen, and we will come to this a little bit in later, governments start to have less of a say. And there are some pretty major implications of what happens when that is the case. The major players in the space sector growing increasingly are no longer the big defense contractors, Boeing, Lockheed. They are some of these media and IT companies. Amazon is planning to launch a constellation of 3,000 satellites. Facebook is looking at lots of different options to provide internet from space. Elementary and high school students are starting to be able to launch satellites because it's possible. So the number of players in the space sector is going up dramatically. And when you have these numbers of players growing, they're also using very different approaches to doing space. And of course, this whole fabric is interconnected, right? So because it's cheaper, you can try different things. You can be more risk-based. So the company Planet, instead of launching a very large single satellite, decided that they would launch hundreds, if not thousands, of little satellites. And that way, they can look at every point in the space at all times. This was a capability that the U.S. government or no government in the world ever had. You know, when we had one large satellite, and we could look at one point at a given time. So now we can have eyes at every point on the globe at all times, and that's something that was enabled not by the government, but by a small private company. It did come from, I mean, it was a spin-off from NASA, and they actually got a lot of government funding, but the point is that having a diverse a number of entities in the space sector brings diverse approaches and much more innovation. Another innovation we are seeing as a result of these drivers is the whole concept of mass manufacturing. Satellites used to be bespoke objects. You know, you would spend 5 years, 3 years making this ginormous satellite and launching it. Now companies like York Systems and actually even companies in Russia and China are looking at mass manufacturing. You know, just like we could mass manufacture automobiles, can we mass manufacture satellites? And again, to some outside the sector, it seems like, of course, you know, mass manufacturing is part of modern society, but this is a new innovation in the space sector. And I think that's the point to make. And in some cases, the government actually poo-pooed these changes, right? So when SpaceX said, hey, we want to reuse and relaunch the first stage of a rocket, the Department of Defense said, you know, one, you can't do it. Two, it's a waste of time and resources. But SpaceX, because they weren't beholden to the government, they weren't a Lockheed Martin or a Boeing, they didn't have to do everything the government asked them to do. They tried it, and it failed a few times, and then it succeeded. And now reusable launch is starting to be considered mainstream. So ULA, the big government contractor, is also now looking at reusing first aid boosters, which of course it's an important innovation because 70% of the cost of a rocket launch is the first stage. So if you can reuse it, it actually is very meaningful. Okay, so we will move on to the next slide. I think I've kind of made the point that there are these emerging changes that are driving the space sector. So on slide 11, I want to start talking about the consequences of these changes. So the first one is, and I have hinted to that all along, is that the space sector is no longer a sort of a single buyer, which is a government, and a very small number of sellers, which is, well, one is government, the other one could be government contractors. So it's no longer that small community, but it's becoming a more globalized mainstream sector. So just like the IT and the computing sectors are large and there are lots of players and a lot of churn in the systems, coming companies, you know, coming in and out, you know, going bankrupt, you will see a lot of this going on. And we already do. I think just in the last 1 year, we've seen several rocket companies, small rocket launchers like Vector, go out of business. And this, you know, this kind of thing didn't used to happen, and we will see it more and more. Globally, there are well over 80 operators in space, and 170 countries and entities have some one or another interest in space. And this is obviously up from the two or three entities that we saw, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. I mean, I want to remind you of the slides I showed up front. I mean, let's not forget the United States is still the dominating player in the room. But I think the point is, and the thing that we need to be ready for, and the thing that I work on with our U.S. government partners and sponsors is, how do we prepare for this new world where the U.S. may not dominate in the next 10, 20, 50 years? Another consequence, going on to the next slide, slide 13, is that many countries in the world are now, because of all of these drivers I mentioned in technology and user base and approaches to development of space technology, they're not following the same pathway the United States developed, right? So we started with, you know, developing a launch sector and then, you know, satellites, and then the satellites got bigger and they got more sophisticated. Many of these companies are able to directly leapfrog from having no space activities or a space ecosystem to having relatively sophisticated satellites. A good example is South Korea. A few years ago, they worked with this UK company called SSTL. SSTL, I think, stands for Surrey Satellite and Technology Limited or something like that. So the first time around, the Koreans paid SSTL to develop a satellite for them and launch it. In a second turn, SSTL worked with Korean scientists to develop, the second generation Korean satellite. And the third time around, the Koreans were happily exceeding the capabilities of SSTL. And so this leapfrogging approach that we have seen in other sectors, like telephony, for example, where in Africa they kind of went from having no telephones, like bypassing the line, the main line, you know, landlines, straight to the cell sector. So the same sort of thing you are seeing in the space sector, and that's important because many of the countries in the world can quickly reach parity with the United States by using this leapfrogging approach. And again, from a national security perspective, that's an important development for us to track. I meant to say slide 12 before. So slide 13 is a third basic consequence of some of these emerging changes. And that one is that as the number of space-based activities grows, as the number of actors in the space sector grow, there are just challenges that we've never faced before, whether it's in space or on the ground. One very specific example is that there's no on-orbit authority in space. There's no rules in space. Anybody can do anything without any consequences, which wasn't really a big problem when there were only 2 to 3 operators in space, right? So if the United States and Soviet Union had some difficulty, they were able to, you know, have a bilateral discussion, solve these issues. But now, as the number of operators is increasing, that is no longer possible. And, you know, high schools in Israel and China can be launching satellites. It's very difficult for the United States to say, hey, your little satellite, which, you know, sometimes are just called beepsats because that's pretty much all they can do, may hit one of our, you know, billion-dollar satellite. Don't do that. But there is no such capability. We have our international regime hasn't grown up enough to be able to have these discussions. Another example is that there's, you know, I'm sure you've heard of U.S. government efforts to have cislunar presence. We do not know if we can own land on the moon. So, you know, we talk about mining water and rare minerals on the moon. We don't know if that's going to be possible. There's no, you know, can, you know, does this belong to all of mankind? Are there any other rules? And of course, as other countries have more capabilities, the United States can no longer say, well, this is the rule. So A couple years ago, I went to the UN meeting on, there's a committee on peaceful uses of outer space. And it was extraordinary to see, you know, countries around the table, you know, Brazil, Iran, and obviously United States and other major spacefaring countries were there as well. But the voice they have was quite, it was interesting to see that, you know, they had a lot to say about how we should be behaving in space. So this whole area of norms in space is becoming a pretty major challenge for the United States. So going on to slide 14, what does this all mean for us? And, you know, this study that we finished, which, I'm happy to send Joan a link for. It was a pretty in-depth report we wrote for various government sponsors. So one of the future implications of these changes is that it would really be difficult to reliably predict developments in the space sector. Because there are so many players, because they are all over the world, because they are using approaches that we had never considered, it's just not possible to know how quickly things would happen. In 2016, I was on a National Academies committee that predicted the ground resolution of small satellites. Today, when I look at the report, I laugh. We were off by a factor of three because we didn't see some of these developments coming. I already mentioned the case of reusability of launchers, right? The government had claimed with confidence that rockets couldn't be reused. SpaceX did it. And now, you know, most of the rest of the world where rockets are being developed, they're all looking at reusable launches. So point being that it's just going to be increasingly more difficult to predict the development in the space sector. Going on to slide 15, a second implication. And again, I have hinted to all of this before. It would be difficult for governments to manage these sectors. When most satellites are not government-owned, and I'm going to show you a data slide in a few seconds, government has less of a say. I don't know if you're following this. Recently, SpaceX launched three or four sets of 60 satellites. So I think they have about 240 satellites in space. And astronomers are getting very concerned that this is affecting their ability to see the night sky. But the government isn't able to speak as much on behalf of the astronomers because satellites are not owned by the government. And of course, if the government did try to get companies to do stuff, they threatened to move offshore. And countries like Luxembourg and Singapore are very obliging to U.S. companies that want to shift because they know the potential of innovation as American companies come to them. And the third and the final implication that we see is that as all of these things happen, the control of the United States in the space sector wanes. And of course, this has some of the biggest national security implications. And these are some of the things that we work through with our government sponsors. So those were some of the global trends that we have seen. Going on to slide 17, I just wanted to say that, you know, the future is hard to predict. These trends, I mean, there's always, you know, wild cards can come into play. So one thing that could happen is, you know, if there's a big solar flare, for example, a big space weather disaster or a cyber event that cripples space-based services for an extended period, and everything comes to a grinding halt. So, you know, a lot of the stuff I talk about doesn't work anymore. Or, and you know, you've all seen the movie, what's it called? Armageddon with Bruce Willis. I mean, what, and you know, it's not, I mean, the whole movie is obviously a total fiction, but the idea that there could be a large earthbound asteroid or comet coming our way, that will change a lot of what we're talking about. So, you know, the future is really hard to predict, but we still need to plan, even as we know that, that, you know, things may happen. So my last slide, and before I go into some data slides, is this one, slide 18. And it's a pretty pictorial way of summarizing global trends in space. We were sort of a gated community, very clean, very organized. We knew exactly how to manage everything. And then it goes from, you know, a lot of people joining, a lot of services being required, and you know, even some destructive capabilities. And at this time, and if you go to slide 19, this is my last slide. You know, the government is trying to figure out its new role. You know, it wants to guide the private sector. It wants to make good decisions, cost-effective decisions for the rest of the space sector. Our dependence on space is only increasing. And even though the government is getting to be a smaller piece of the whole pie, it is still a pretty important piece. So that's what I wanted to say. If we could just quickly switch to slide 23, is that possible? I wanted to kind of give one data point on the shrinking role of the government. So if you look at the slide, the x-axis is the year, and the y-axis is the number of satellites launched. And the golden rod, the yellow color, is commercial. And you can see from 2012 to 2019 how spectacularly the number of commercial entities have increased the launch cadence in space. And again, quickly, if we can look at slide 24 and 25 and 26, slide 24 is the number of countries in the space sector in 1990. It's about 15 countries. If you go to slide 25, it's data for 2016. You can already see the extraordinary increase in the number of countries that are players. And if you go to slide 26, you will see, I mean, the trend just deepen. And I want to stop on this slide and turn to questions with the note that with all of what I've been saying about trends, one thing to note is we are still the largest player in the game. I'm happy to take questions. I hope the talk was helpful. Come on, okay. You must have some questions.
We've got a question, I think, right here. And as others have questions, why don't you feel free to come up to the front row and take the next available seat.
Dr. Lal, thank you for your presentation, and thank you for working with us today. I read this morning in one of the newspapers that the administration has requested a 12% increase in the NASA budget, the bulk of which is earmarked for putting Americans back on the moon. In your view, is this the best use of those resources, or should we use that money to pursue some other endeavor in space? Thank you.
So that's a really great question. And I think it depends, I think we have to decide as a society what we want to get out of space. So. And there's different opinions and different communities. There are some who believe that space should only be about national welfare, right? So we need to spend our space resources on Earth observation, issues like climate change, understanding the behavior of oceans and forest fires and that sort of thing. So that's one group that takes space in the service of Earth. There's a second group that believes pretty strongly that eventually something would go wrong on Earth. Either we'll be hit by an asteroid, or, you know, we will destroy ourselves with, you know, climate change or however, nuclear weapons, and that we need to have a plan B. We need to spread out into the solar system, expand our footprint. If you believe, if you are part of that second group where you think we need to settle the rest of the universe, going to the moon is an essential first step. We need to learn how to live off-world. We need to learn how to use local resources. The ultimate idea is not just the moon, but then going from moon to Mars, which is part of what Congress would like NASA to do. They're not such big fans of the moon. They think we should do on the moon only what is relevant for being on Mars. And so that's one community. I don't think there's a right and a wrong answer. I think we as a society have to decide how we want to allocate our resources. And I think NASA is likely doing a pretty good job. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but about a third of our resources go into science, sort of understanding the universe, you know, is there life out there? How does the rest of the solar system look like? And then another third is going to human exploration activities, rockets like the SLS, which will take us to the moon and Mars. And another third is other sorts of things, Earth observation, education, and other activities. So I think we have generally the proportion right, but since we are a democracy, I think the citizens get to say how we want to, you know, if we want to, you know, make any differences there. Maybe we want to spend maybe the next decade looking more at climate change related issues and then scale back on getting to the moon. But then that's where we get to go to the voting booths, right? I hope that answered the question.
And we have another question coming.
Yes, good morning, Doctor. My name's Tom Hatfield. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Hillsdale College magazine or a newsletter called Imprimis, but the most recent letter is written by a retired Air Force general who said that America is making a serious mistake in putting the Space Force under the auspices of the Air Force, because we tend to always fight the next war with the last war's equipment, and the Air Force doesn't see the space as anything more than just an adjunct to what we're doing now. Have you any, what he goes on to say is that China is rapidly overtaking us in space and that the next war will be fought in space and China will be the dominant figure unless America does a better job of it. Thank you.
Sure. So I think you have a lot of things there, and I'll try to hit them one after the other. I want to start with the last point. China is overtaking us in space. I mean, I think one of the reasons I showed you some of the charts on you know, relative investment. If Joan, you wouldn't mind going to slide, which slide was that? Slide six. Yes, China is the second largest player in space, but it is, you know, in terms of just sheer number of dollars, you know, nowhere near the United States. So I think we just need to start with, yes, China is growing fast. They have military ambitions. They are well organized to do things in space, but they are not overtaking us quite yet. I mean, yes, they could in the future, and we have to be prepared. We need to make sure that that doesn't happen. So anyway, that's just point number one. Point number two, I have not read that newsletter, but that is a pretty prevailing view that having the Space Force be part of the Air Force is likely not a good idea. And one reason many folks have, Secretary Heather Wilson, the former Secretary of the Air Force, felt pretty strongly that Space Force should be part of Air Force, right? And part of it is just bureaucracy, right? I mean, why would the Air Force want to let go of, you know, tens of billions of dollars to a different entity? So, you know, bureaucratic inertia is part of the human fabric, and we just need to fight it. I think the president had, you know, did have a space policy directive, I think number 4 or number 5, that creates the Space Force, and Congress in the last NDAA did ask for a 6th military service that organizes, trains, and equips military personnel for space. So I think we are, this will remain controversial for a little bit, but I think we are on our way to have a Space Force. I think the very last point I want to make is that as we design the Space Force, we need to understand what are the problems we are trying to solve, and solve those problems as opposed to trying to prepare for something that that is more imaginary. I mean, so some of the things I hear is, you know, will we have human beings be going into space as part of the Space Force? That is likely not true. I think a lot of what Space Force will do is combine a scattered set of functions. So right now there's more than 60 organizations across DoD and the intelligence community with responsibilities for space acquisitions. The space workforce is scattered across the services and the intelligence agencies as well. And there's conflict of interest when it comes to space, because each of the services are organized around their domain of expertise, as in, you know, air for Air Force, space tends to get neglected. So those are the sorts of problems we want to be solving. And I think at this point, especially in Washington, D.C., there's beginning to be consensus that we do need an independent Space Force.